Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hi and welcome to Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to writer Masha Gessen. Masha Gessen is a journalist who has written for Slate, Seed, The New Republic, The New York Times, and other publications. Her previous books include Blood Matters, A Journey Along the Genetic Frontier, and her latest is Perfect Rigor, A Genius and the Mathematical Breakthrough of the Century. Now, this interview was recorded over quite a poor telephone line to Russia, so the sound quality isn't particularly great, but it's a really good interview, so I hope you enjoy it anyway. I'm speaking to Masha Gessen. Thank you, Masha, for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing to say about Perfect Rigor is that it's a book about a man who is ostensibly a recluse now, so you never get a chance to speak to him. So let's talk about what challenges that poses to you on writing the book.
Well, I interviewed pretty much everybody who ever went to school with, worked with, was friends with, organized events with Perelman. I was lucky that all of them agreed to talk to me. The project presented a challenge in that I had to construct an image of this person whom I never saw and never heard. At the same time, it was sort of gratifying because when you write a traditional biography, you're always beholden to the image that your subject has of himself and his own vision of his project and his own vision of his personal traits and his own vision of his personal history, much of which may not actually jive with what you as a reporter see or with what people on the outside see. In this case, I had more freedom because I didn't have to consider Perelman's own image of himself. I could guess at it, it was fodder for my mill, just as everything that I was told was.
It also gives the book an element of a mystery story as well, which I think really works.
That's how I thought of it. I thought of it as a quest.
Let's talk a little bit, first of all, about the background of the sort of the maths under the Soviet system, which Perelman went through, and indeed you've been through that same system yourself. So let's talk about what was unique about the Soviet system for maths.
There were many fascinating things about it, and I have to admit that the part of the book that concerns the math school system and the whole mathematics subculture in the Soviet Union was actually probably twice as large before I started editing the manuscript. I really dug into it, and I found it absolutely fascinating. What I write about is that after World War II, the Soviet Union invested heavily in math, sciences, and technology. Obviously, this was part of their arms race. And it created an opportunity for a number of thinking people to sort of carve a niche for themselves and for children that they wanted to educate. There was a great mathematician named Kolmogorov. He is one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, not just in the Soviet Union, but in all the world. He had decided as a young man that he was going to devote his later years to inventing an educational system for children. And so he did devote himself entirely to inventing a school system. He was an extremely well-educated man, not just a talented mathematician, but someone who, unusually for a Soviet person, had lived abroad in the interwar period, had been exposed to much classical culture, classical music. He was quite a music aficionado. And so he created what he considered an ideal school, a school that was mostly a school for boys, that placed a great emphasis on not only the study of mathematics, but also the study of physical culture and music. I should also probably say that Kolmogorov was gay, and oddly for the Soviet environment, was quasi-openly gay. And so he created this sort of Soviet vision of a Greek school, which was entirely world unto itself. And so strong was his influence and so strong was the institutional memory of these schools that long after he died, the schools continued to sort of carry his legacy and to carry his imprint. And Perelman went to one of those schools.
You mentioned the idea that he was gay, and that was obviously illegal under the Soviet system, but he was pretty much left alone to his own devices. And this seems to happen again and again to mathematicians at the time. Although, interestingly, you talk about this idea that maths itself, the very study of maths, was somehow the opposite of the shifting truths of the Soviet political system, because obviously it was concerned with absolute truths. So why do you think maths somehow was a special case under the Soviet system? Why do you think it tended to be left alone?
Well, in a sense, that's two separate questions. One is, how is it possible that a man who was almost openly gay was left alone? I think that the thing is that in the Soviet Union, everything was illegal. It's not just that male homosexuality was illegal, you know. Private trade was illegal. Private initiative of any sort was illegal. The possession of hard currency was illegal. The study of Hebrew was illegal. Many, many things were illegal. So, in a sense, every person in Soviet society, or every person with any kind of initiative, was outside the law, which means that the law was always enforced selectively. Mm-hmm. It was not enforced against Kolmogorov, because Kolmogorov was hugely valuable to the Soviet system. He was the greatest mathematician the Soviet Union had ever known. He had also made a great contribution to the defense industry, including during World War II. So he was left alone because he was needed. The same, in a sense, could be said of mathematics in general. Mathematics was very much needed for the Soviet arms race. And so mathematicians were allowed to create small oases of scholarly activity in which the state did not intervene. Mathematics itself obviously does not lend itself to the kind of ideological influence that can be exercised over the humanities or the study of history. Mathematics sort of doesn't allow more than one correct solution. And even during Stalin's time, when Stalin sort of consecutively involved himself in a number of disciplines, declaring himself a linguist first and then purging a variety of other disciplines, including history, a public campaign against mathematicians was in the works, but it never took off because it was very difficult to lodge an ideologically resonant campaign about mathematics. Ultimately, who cares what mathematicians think about numbers?
There's another aspect of the Soviet mathematical world that's interesting, is incredibly important in Perelman's development, and this is the idea of competitive maths clubs. Tell us a little bit about that. And there's a man, Sergei Rukshin, who becomes incredibly central to Perelman's life. So tell us a little bit about the maths clubs.
Right, the maths clubs were part of the mathematics subculture. In a sense, what happened in Soviet maths was that it sort of got divided into official and unofficial mathematics. Official mathematics was a part of the party nomenclature and very much a part of the sort of the party-controlled system of redistribution of wealth and benefits. Unofficial mathematics was pure mathematics. These people mostly worked at some research institute or another, doing work within those institutes of some application to industry, but not of scholarly significance. And then they would gather for their little workshops in somebody's house once a week and discuss their actual math work. And the math clubs, in a sense, were part of that culture. There were clubs for kids who wanted to learn to solve problems. And often, as was the case with the math club that Perelman attended, which was led by Sergei Rukshin, they were little tiny cults that expected total devotion from the children who attended. And Perelman was a special project of Rukshin's. Rukshin was a very, very young instructor who was not a particularly successful mathematician himself, but he thought he had the secret to making great mathematical competitors, people who could travel to mathematics Olympiads and solve problems. And he constituted Perelman as the child who seemed sort of most absorbent. And he was absolutely right. Perelman was his most successful project. In fact, he's probably the most successful mathematics Olympiad problem solver ever.
Let's talk a little bit about Perelman then. Give us a little flavor of who he is at this point.
Well, Perelman is a graduate of a mathematics school and a graduate of the Mathematics Club. He has taken part in a number of mathematics competitions, and he's now traveled to the most important mathematics competition of them all, which is the International Mathematics Olympiad in Budapest, and he's gotten a perfect score. That, among other things, is important because it gets him into university without exams in the Soviet Union. For a Jew, quite a coup. Even for a Jew as talented and able as Perelman, because university admissions for Jews were highly sort of rationed and regulated. Most Jewish high school graduates had no hope of getting into one of the big universities.
After his university career, Perelman goes over to America, and so let's sort of talk a little bit about his early career as... Although he is clearly, you know, something of a prodigy and somewhat unusual in his personal habits, perhaps, at this moment he doesn't seem that much different from most other mathematicians.
Mathematics is very tolerant of eccentrics. So mm-hmm. Mathematicians are often not particularly sort of socially adaptable and adapted people. So Perelman, with his refusal to cut his hair, to cut his fingernails, or his... utter disregard for the need to change his clothes, was not unusual at all. And he also was incredibly lucky. People sort of took a mentoring position toward him and guided him through major career milestones in ways that allowed him to concentrate on his own work. So he was guided gently from university to graduate school. And just as he was finishing graduate school, in St. Petersburg, he was picked up by a great emigre geometer named Mikhail Gromov, who took a huge interest in Perelman and got him a fellowship at a math institute outside of Paris. So that was how Perelman first emerged from Russian math and onto the world stage. From there, he got picked up by a couple of programs in the U.S., so he spent a year at New York University at the Courant Institute, which is one of the most important hotbeds of mathematical activity in the world. And then he went to Berkeley on a dream scholarship that allowed him to participate in university life and concentrate on his own work. He did some of his very important work while he was in the States.
Okay, so the point where he gets to Berkeley is quite an important point in his life, because so far he has been working on something called Alexandrov spaces. He basically comes to a dead end with that, and he pretty much abandons his work when he's at Berkeley on the Alexandrov spaces. So this is the point where I suppose he's now going to head towards the Poincaré conjecture. So perhaps we should, first of all, let's remind ourselves who Poincaré was and briefly what his conjecture was.
Well, actually, let me backtrack a little bit. While he was in New York, he proved a theorem called the Sol conjecture.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
Which was a beautiful, small, unsolved problem within geometry. And he made a huge name for himself among geometers by solving the Sol conjecture, partly because no one had solved it before, obviously, but partly because his proof was so elegant and so short, so concise, that... anybody who was paying attention to that part of the field knew that Perelman was a major player. And this was important in attracting attention to his eventual proof of the Poincaré conjecture, because even though the circle of people concerned with the Sol conjecture was rather small, they knew that Perelman was somebody that one should pay attention to. Because actually, unknown mathematicians who claimed to solve the Poincaré conjecture popped up at least once a year somewhere on the internet. Perelman wasn't one of them, obviously. But Henri Poincaré was a great French, not just mathematician. He was, some people call him the last universalist. He was a great French scientist. And he posited a problem in the field of topology, which is sort of a field adjacent to the kind of high school geometry that we all know, but rather different. It's a field concerned with the qualities of objects, the qualities of imaginary objects, right? Objects that exist in multidimensional spaces. Topologists posit conjectures about their qualities and then prove whether or not this is correct in the conditions of this imaginary four-dimensional, five-dimensional, seven-dimensional, et cetera, space. So Henri Poincaré posed a question that sounds rather simple. Essentially, it's that if you have something three-dimensional in a four-dimensional space that has all the qualities of a sphere, is it necessarily a sphere? Mm-hmm. Right. So it has no holes, it has no knots, and it's some sort of thing, some sort of blob. Is it always a sphere? Can it be something else, something that does not possess the qualities of a sphere? So Poincaré initially posed the question and then thought he answered it. Then he found a flaw in his proof. And then it was 100 years before Perelman proved it. And as I said, once every year or two, somebody thought to have proved it and was always ultimately wrong.
Let's look at a couple of those steps along the way then, because there are a couple of other mathematicians that are very important in Perelman's story. And I'm thinking of Thurston and Hamilton here. So perhaps we could have a quick look at what contributions they made.
Right. Well, first of all, there are actually a couple of mathematicians who proved the Poincaré conjecture for more dimensional spaces. That's proof for five dimensions and four dimensions. But the three-dimensional sphere remained elusive. And the reason it remained elusive was that if you can imagine it, for a topologist, there's sort of less room to move about in a four-dimensional space than there is in a more-dimensional space. There are fewer tricks of the trade to apply to imagining this object. Now, William Thurston is an American mathematician who actually made a huge step forward in topology by creating what's called the geometrization conjecture, which essentially posits that every imaginable shape or object is composed of eight known defined geometries. Right? So not necessarily of all eight, but there are eight geometries that can be used to create any object that can possibly be imagined. Now, for Thurston's geometrization conjecture to be true, the Poincaré conjecture had to be true. And what Perelman actually did was he proved the geometrization conjecture, proving the Poincaré conjecture along the way. So the problem he solved was even bigger than the Poincaré conjecture, which no one had solved in 100 years. Now, Richard Hamilton is also an American mathematician who actually devised a way to prove the Poincaré conjecture. And this is something that's important, I think, to understanding the nature of Perelman's genius, because in mathematics, it's generally believed that there are sort of three kinds of mathematicians. The really, really, really great ones are the ones who pose original questions. So like Poincaré posed the question about the three-dimensional sphere that no one could answer for 100 years. Then there are another great ones, but not quite as great as Poincaré. They're the ones who find ways to solve those problems. And then there are the good mathematicians, the ones who solve the problems following the program set out by someone else. So in a sense, Perelman actually falls into this not terribly prestigious category of essentially problem solvers, which is what Rukshin taught him to do, which is why I said that he is the greatest mathematics Olympiad problem solver of all time. In a way, for him, the Poincaré conjecture was an Olympiad problem in that it was posed by somebody else, and even the way to solve it was laid out by somebody else. Now, the thing is that when Hamilton created what mathematicians call a program for solving the Poincaré conjecture, he got lost in the complexities of that problem. The technical expertise and the technical acumen needed to follow the program he had laid out was greater than that possessed by any mathematician living until Perelman came along. It just got too hard for Hamilton to follow, and Perelman managed to solve all the technical problems.
We can't really go into the details of what he did and how he solved it. I wouldn't ask you to do that. But let's talk about what happened then. So Perelman, basically, he takes a slightly unusual step of announcing that he's Well, he doesn't even really announce that he's solved it, but he posts his results. He posts his paper on an internet forum.
Right. He actually posted his paper in three installments, and somewhere around page 8 of the first installment, he had moved past where Hamilton had gotten the signs and was into the territory of proving the Poincaré conjecture. One of his colleagues actually wrote to him asking, have you proved the Poincaré conjecture? And that's when Perelman responded, yes, I have. But he laid no such claim out in an open forum. His proof was incredibly concise, just as his proof of the Searle conjecture had been. So in all, I think the three installments added up to about 75 to 80 pages printed out. And it took three teams of a couple of mathematicians each 2 years to go through the proof and explicate it and write up papers of about 1,000 pages each, or books of 1,000 pages each, explicating the proof for a general mathematics community. So that's just to give you an idea of how complicated the proof is. Now, what Perelman did in posting the proof on the archive.org website is not that unusual. Mathematicians often post what are considered preprints on the archive. What was unusual was that he had no intention of sending it to a referee journal. He had no intention of publishing it in traditional form. He had no intention of discussing his proof with anybody. That is, he was willing to lecture on it. But he had absolutely no interest in laying claim to having proved the Poincaré conjecture. That he left to other people to do.
So all of this time when he was working on it, he'd already sort of withdrawn himself from the mathematical community. There was almost a sense of betrayal that he felt towards the sort of wider mathematical community. Should we talk about why that was?
Well, Perelman's life is actually a chain of narrowing his social circle down until he was down to his mother, who's the only person he talks to now on a regular basis. I believe that whenever he encountered evidence that the world didn't work in ways that he expected it to, he would cut off that part of the world. So, for example, when he was a university student and he was teaching at mathematics summer school along with some of his colleagues, he discovered that one of these colleagues did not always tell the truth. Now, she didn't actually lie to him. Somehow it just came to his attention that she didn't always tell the truth. So he said to Sergei Rukshin, who was the organizer of the summer schools, that he was no longer willing to teach in the same summer school with her. And that's how he cut off part of his world. Then he got into some conflicts at his research institute over, say, footnoting. He believes that routine footnoting practices among mathematicians, which essentially allow the citation of the latest or the most convenient paper that contains, say, particular solutions, are unethical and should be banned. That it should always be the original paper that contains that particular solution. So as a result, he actually has an unpublished paper that he co-authored with another Russian mathematician whose footnoting practices he then grew to disapprove, and so he refuses to interact with him. He had a falling out with his dissertation advisor over footnoting practices in his dissertation advisor's lab. He quit the Mathematics Research Institute following a number of conflicts, including one in which he received a little bit more money than he usually got in his salary because a grant, there was some money left over from a research grant, and that money had been distributed equally among researchers in a particular lab. And because he had not taken part in the research for which the grant was given, he believed this was unethical, staged a huge fight, forced the accounting office at the institute to process the money and take it back, and really just made everybody's life hell until this issue was resolved. So that's why the book is called Perfect Rigor. Perfect Rigor is a quote from a Poincaré paper on the nature of mathematical proof. But Perfect Rigor is also clearly the way that Perelman views the world and expects it to be perfect in ways that the world full of humans simply cannot be.
We're nearly out of time, but let's just finish off then with, you know, with a look at, you know, one aspect of how that after effects of that worldview. We haven't mentioned throughout the interview that the Poincaré conjecture was one of the seven unsolved problems, the Millennium Problems, published by the Clay Institute, and it has, for its solving, a prize of $1 million. There was a prize ceremony in Paris in 2010 to basically award Perlman with the achievement of solving the Poincaré conjecture. So tell us what happened there.
Well, actually, this was the third time that Perlman had turned down a prize. He had turned down a European prize for young mathematicians, and his explanation for that was that the people who were in the jury of awarding the prize were not qualified to judge his accomplishments. He then turned down the Fields Medal, which is the most prestigious prize in mathematics. It's often called the Mathematical Nobel Prize. And this was because the Fields Medal is awarded to practicing mathematicians. And at this point, he had decided he was no longer a mathematician, so he said he couldn't take the Fields Medal. And finally, he turned down the Clay Million because he said it should have been awarded in part to him and Hamilton. And because Hamilton was given no credit, he wasn't going to take the $1 million. I think these are all, as is always the case with Perlman, rational explanations, and they're difficult to contradict. At the same time, I think he has a basic objection to the monetization of achievement in mathematics. I think he believes it to be utterly inappropriate and sort of unmathematical.
We should establish that, you know, he's not some reclusive millionaire. I mean, he lives with very limited means.
He lives on the outskirts of St. Petersburg in a small apartment with his mother, and their only source of income is his mother's very, very small pension.
You just mentioned that, you know, he no longer considers himself, or at this point he doesn't consider himself to be a mathematician. So, I mean, is that it? I mean, do we know what he's doing? Has he abandoned it completely, or is this just a temporary thing, do you think?
I'm afraid it's over. I don't think he's doing mathematics, and I don't think he's going to do mathematics again. The world of mathematics has disappointed him, largely because of what happened following his proof of the Poincaré conjecture. He perceived this great desire to monetize his achievement. He was hugely resentful of all the professorship offers that he got as a result of his proof. He's resentful of the $1 million. He's resentful of the media attention because it vulgarizes mathematics. And most of all, he's disappointed with what he sees as the mathematical world's complicity in this monetization and vulgarization of mathematics. So he's abandoned the world of mathematics.
And that's obviously a great loss to the world of mathematics.
Clearly.
Masha, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today. It's been great.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.